Flashman at the Charge by George MacDonald Fraser, concluded. Cassette 8, Side 2.
They will not come yet to spoil all this,
and he gestured round at the crowd streaming by,
or come at all if I can help it. And if they do, well, there is still Kashgar and a free place in the hills, where the wicked cease from troubling, eh?
Says I, because it seemed appropriate.
Is that an English saying?
He asked.
I think it's a hymn.
If I remember rightly, we used to sing it in chapel at Rugby before the miscreants of the day got flogged.
All holy songs are made of dreams, says he, and this is a great place for dreams such as mine. You know where we are, Englishman?
He pointed along the dusty track which wound in and out of the little sandhills, and then ran like a yellow ribbon across the plain before it forked towards the great white barriers of the Afghan mountains.
This is the great pathway of expectation, as the hill people say, where you may realize your hopes just by hoping them. The Chinese call it the Baghdad Highway, and the Persians and Hindus know it as the Silk Trail, but we call it the Golden Road.
And he quoted a verse which, with considerable trouble, I've turned into rhyming English. To learn the age-old lesson day by day, it is not in the bright arrival planned, but in the dreams men dream along the way, they find the golden road to Samarkand.
Very pretty, says I. Make it up yourself.
He laughed.
No, it's an old song, perhaps Firdausi or Omar. Anyway, it will take me to Kashgar, if I live long enough. But here are the others, and here we say farewell. You are my guest sent to me from heaven. Touch upon my hand in parting.
So we shook, and then the others arrived, and Kutabar was gripping me by the shoulders in his great bear hug and shouting, God be with you, Flashman, and my compliments to the scientists and doctors in Anglistan. And Ko Dali's daughter approached demurely to give me the gift of her scarf and kiss me gently on the lips. And just for an instant the minx's tongue was halfway down my throat before she withdrew, looking like St. Cecilia.
Jacob Beg shook hands again and wheeled his horse. Goodbye, blood brother. Think of us in England. Come and visit us in Kashgar some day, or better still, find a Kashgar of your own.
And then they were thundering away back on the Samarkand Road, cloaks flying and Kutabar turning in the saddle to give me a wave and a roar. And it's odd, but for a moment I felt lonely and wondered if I should miss them. It was a deeply felt sentimental mood which lasted for at least a quarter of a second and has never returned, I'm happy to say. As to Kashgar and Jakob's invitation, well, if I could get guaranteed passports from the Tsar and the Empress of China and every hill chief between Astrakhan and Lake Baikal, and a private Pullman car the whole way with running buffet, bar, and waitresses in constant attendance, I might think quite hard about it before declining. I've too many vivid memories of Central Asia. At my time of life, Scarborough is far enough east for me. It was strange, though, to go back into Afghanistan again with my escort. Heaven knows where Jacob had got them from. But one look at their wolfish faces and well-stuffed cartridge belts reassured me that this was one party that no right-minded badmash would dream of attacking. It took us a week over the Hindu killer, and another couple of days through the hills to Kabul, and suddenly there was the old Bala Hisar again, and I sat in disbelief, looking across to the overgrown orchards where Elfie Bey's cantonment had been so many years ago, and the Kabul River, and the hillside where Akbar had spread his carpet and Macnaghten had died. I could close my eyes and almost hear the drums of the 44th beating Yankee Doodle, an old lady's sail berating some unfortunate bearer for brewing tea before the water was thoroughly boiling. I even took a turn up by the ruined residency and found my heart beating faster as I looked at the bullet-pocked walls and marked the window where Broadfoot had tumbled to his death. And from there I turned and tried to find the spot where the Ghazis had set on me and the Burns brothers, but I couldn't find it. It was strange, everything the same and yet different. I stood looking round at the close-packed houses and wondered in which one Gul Shah had tried to murder me with his infernal snakes. And at that I found myself shivering and hurrying back to the market, where my escort were waiting. Sometimes ghosts can hover in too close for comfort. I didn't want to linger in Kabul any longer. And to the astonishment of my escort, I insisted that we journey on to Peshawar by the north bank of the Kabul River, although, as the leader pointed out, there was a fine road by way of Boothak and Jalalabad to the south.
"There are serais, Huzoor," says he, "and all comfort for us and our beasts. This way is broken country, where we must lie out by night in the cold. Truly the south road is better."
"My son," says I, "when you were a Chota Wala, a little fella, gurgling your mother's milk, I travelled that south road, and I didn't like it one little bit. So we'll stick to the river, if you don't mind."
"Aye," says he, grinning with his jagged teeth. "Perchance you owe money to someone in Jalalabad."
"No," says I, "not money. Lead on, friend of all travellers, to the river." So that way we went, and cold it was by night, but I didn't have nightmares, waking or sleeping, all the way to the Khyber and the winding road down to Peshawar, where I said goodbye to my escort and rode under the arch where Avitabile used to hang the Gilzais, and so into the presence of a young whippersnapper of a company ensign. "A very good day to you, old boy," says I. "I'm Flashman." He was a fishy-looking, fresh young lad with a peeling nose, and he goggled at me, going red.
"Sergeant," he squeaks, "what's this beastly-looking nigger doing on the office veranda?"
For I was attired, a la Kizil Kum still, in cloak and pyjamas and puggaree, with a bigger beard than Dr. Grace.
"Not at all," says I affably. "I'm English, a British officer, in fact. Name of Flashman, Colonel Flashman, 17th Lancers, but slightly detached for the moment. I've just come from up yonder, at considerable personal expense, and I'd like to see someone in authority. Your commanding officer will do."
"It's a madman," cries he. "Sergeant, stand by."
And would you believe it, it took me half an hour before I could convince him not to throw me in the lock-up. And he summoned a peevish-looking captain, who listened, nodding irritably, while I explained who and what I was. "Very good," says he. "You've come from Afghanistan." "By way of Afghanistan, yes, but very good. This is a customs post, among other things. Have you anything to declare?"
The end of the fourth packet of the Flashman papers. There follow two appendices. The first, Balaclava. So much has been written about this battle by its survivors, by journalists and historians, and even by propagandists and poets, that it is hardly necessary to say more than that Flashman's account, while it adds certain graphic details that have not been recorded hitherto, agrees substantially with other eyewitness descriptions. Much of what he says of the actual charge of the Light Brigade, for example, may be verified by comparison with the accounts of those who survived the action, such as Paget, Trooper Farquharson, Captain Morgan, Cardigan, and others. But the great controversy of Balaclava, which will probably never be settled satisfactorily, is why the Light Brigade attacked the battery at all. Experts and amateurs of history alike, who have read Russell, Kinglake, Woodham Smith, Fortescue, and a host of others, and who are familiar with the points of view of Raglan, Lucan, and Cardigan, may decide for themselves whether Flashman casts valuable light on the subject or not. Many believe that Raglan and Airy were principally at fault for issuing an imprecise order, that Nolan's excitement in transmitting it to Lucan led to the final fatal confusion, and that neither Cardigan nor Lucan can be fairly blamed for what followed. These are conclusions with which Flashman himself would obviously not disagree. The whole question hinges dramatically on the moment when Nolan made his wild gesture. Down the valley? Towards the redoubts? How great was the angle of difference anyway? Did he say our guns? Or your guns? Or what? And if he was at fault, he paid the highest price for it. So too, perhaps, did Raglan. He died in the Crimea, like the 600 Sabres, and if there was a blunder, it was buried with them. Appendix 2, Yakub Beg and Izzat Kutebar. Yakub Beg, who became the greatest chief in Central Asia and the leading resistance fighter against Russian imperialism, was born in Piskent in 1820. He was one of the Persian Tajik people and a descendant of Tamerlane the Great, Timur. Flashman's description of him corresponds closely to the reconstruction of features recently made from Timur's skull by the Russian expert Professor Gerasimov. In 1845, Yakub became chamberlain to the Khan of Khokand, and then Pansad Bashi, commander of 500. He was made Kushbegi, military commander, and governor of Akhmachet, an important fortress on the Sirdarya, in 1847. And in the same year, married a girl from Julek, a river town. She is described as a Kipchak lady of the Golden Horde. Yakub was active in raiding the new Russian outposts on the Aral coast, and after the fall of Akhmachet in 1853, he made strenuous efforts to retake it from the Russians without success. After the Russian invasion, Yakub eventually turned his attention to making his own state in Kashgar. In 1865, as commander-in-chief to the decadent Buzurg Khan, he took Kashgar, then dispossessed his own overlord and assumed the throne himself as Amir and Atalik Ghazi. In the same year, he married the beautiful daughter of Khodali, an officer in the Chinese army, by whom he had several children. As ruler of Kashgar and East Turkestan, Yakub Beg was the most powerful monarch of Central Asia. He remained a bitter enemy of Russia and a close friend of the British, whose envoys were received in Kashgar, where a British-Kashgari commercial treaty was concluded in 1874. It was Russia's fear that he would eventually unite all the Muslims of Central Asia in a holy war against the Tsar. But in 1876, Kashgar was attacked by China, and Yakub was driven out. He was assassinated on May 1, 1877, by Hakim Khan, a son of Buzurg Khan. His biographer has described Yakub Beg as a great man born centuries too late. Certainly, as a nationalist leader and resistance fighter, he was unique in his time and country, for alone in Central Asia he remained free. And he fought his campaigns and ruled his independent state without wealth or any large following. His great gifts, according to contemporaries, were a keen intelligence, a winning and handsome appearance, and a refusal to be panicked. He also seems to have had a sense of timing, as witness the neatness with which he betrayed Buzurg Khan. Anywhere else in the world, he would probably be remembered as William Wallace, Harrywood, and Crazy Horse are remembered, but not in modern Russia. In Tashkent recently, I asked an educated Russian what kind of place Yakub Beg occupied in local history. His name was not even known. İzzat Kutebar, brigand, rebel, and guerrilla leader, was a Kyrgyz, born probably in 1800. He first robbed the Bukhara caravan in 1822, and was at his height as a raider and scourge of the Russians in the 1840s. They eventually persuaded him to suspend his bandit activities and rewarded him with a gold medal. But he cut loose again in the early 50s, was captured in 1854, escaped, or was released, raised a revolt, and lived as a rebel in the Ust Yurt until 1858, when he finally surrendered to Count Ignatieff and made his peace with Russia. This concludes the reading of Flashman at the Charge, by George MacDonald Fraser. This book was read by David Case. Additional titles by George MacDonald Fraser in the Books on Tape Library include Flashman, Royal Flash, and Flash for Freedom. For additional information about them, or for help with topics of related interest, please call our customer service department or check our catalogue index to find review material.
We hope you enjoyed this reading. Please continue listening to sample another Books on Tape bestseller.
Budding Prospects, a Pastoral, by T. Carragason Boyle. Copyright 1984 by T. Carragason Boyle. This recording of the full-length reading of Budding Prospects was published by arrangement with the author and was produced in 1994 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. This book is read by Jonathan Rees. Budding Prospects by T. Carragason Boyle. This book consists of four parts, has 26 chapters, and is 326 pages long. The following material appears on the jacket of the book. A First-Rate Picaresque Adventure, Los Angeles Times. Mr. Boyle possesses a rare and redeeming virtue. He can be consistently, effortlessly, intelligently funny. Eva Hoffman, The New York Times. Wastrel Felix Naismith and two friends are presented with an irresistible scheme to make more than $1 million. All they have to do is harvest a crop of cannabis sativa, a potent marijuana plant, in the lonely hills of Northern California. But Felix and company don't reckon on nosy neighbors, torrential rain, demands of the flesh, and Felix's improbable new love, a wayward sculptress on whose behalf he undertakes a one-man vendetta against a drug-busting state trooper named Jerback. As their deal escalates through crises into nightmare, their dreams of easy money get nipped in the bud. Budding prospects sparkles with memorably eccentric characters, extraordinary adventures, and dazzling humor. Lusty in every sense of the word, healthy, invigorating, and strong. The New York Times Book Review. Boyle's characters, for all their grotesqueries, are wonderful and believable. Each scene is marvelously and sensually constructed. The Dallas Morning News. Gulp it down. It beats getting drunk. Salman Rushdie. T. Karagason Boyle is a native of Peekskill, New York. He is the author of the novels World's End, 1987, winner of the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, Water Music, 1982, and the forthcoming East is East, as well as three short story collections, Descent of Man, 1979, Greasy Lake and Other Stories, 1985, and If the River Was Whiskey, 1989. His fiction has appeared in most of the major American magazines, including Esquire, Harper's, The Paris Review, and The Atlantic Monthly. He currently lives in Los Angeles. This book is for my horticultural friends. Plow deep while sluggards sleep, and you shall have corn to sell and to keep. Benjamin Franklin, The Way to Wealth. Why, boys, when I was 17, I walked into the jungle, and when I was 21, I walked out. And by God, I was rich. Arthur Miller, Death of a Salesman. Part 1, Preparing the Soil. Chapter 1. I've always been a quitter. I quit the Boy Scouts, the Glee Club, the Marching Band. Gave up my paper route, turned my back on the church, stuffed the basketball team. I dropped out of college, sidestepped the Army with a 4F on the grounds of mental instability, went back to school, made a go of it, entered a PhD program in 19th century British literature, sat in the front row, took notes assiduously, bought a pair of horn rims, and quit on the eve of my comprehensive exams. I got married, separated, divorced. Quit smoking, quit jogging, quit eating red meat. I quit jobs, digging graves, pumping gas, selling insurance, showing pornographic films in an art theater in Boston. When I was 19, I made frantic love to a pinch-faced, sack-bosomed girl I'd known from high school. She got pregnant. I quit town. About the only thing I didn't give up on was the summer camp. Let me tell you about it. 2 years ago, I was living alone. I woke alone, flossed my teeth alone, worked at odd jobs, ate takeout burritos, read the newspaper, and undressed for bed alone. The universe had temporarily pulled in its boundaries, and I was learning to adjust to them. I was 31. I sat at the lunch counter with men of 51, 61, 81, slurped tomato rice soup and watched the waitress. Sometimes I had dinner with friends, shot pool, went to the aquarium, danced to a pulsing Latino beat in close atrometal clubs. Sometimes I felt like a bearded ascetic contemplating the stones of the desert. On this particular night, it was in late February, I stayed in. I was reading, absorbed in an assault on K2 by a team of Japanese mountaineers, my lungs constricting in the thin, burning air, the deadly sting of wind-lashed ice in my face, when the record, the Rite of Spring, caught in the groove with a gnashing squeal, as if a stage full of naiads, dryads, and spandex satyrs had simultaneously gone lame. I looked up from my book. Rain knocked at the windows like a smirking voyeur. Small sounds reverberated through the house. The clank of the refrigerator closing down. The sigh of the heat starting up. The fire crackled ominously around a nail in a charred 2x4. At that instant, as if on cue, the front buzzer sounded. It was after 12. I gave the tube a rueful glance. Zombies in white face drifted across the screen, masticating bratwurst-like strings of human intestine. Put down my book, cinched the terry cloth robe round my waist, and ambled to the head of the stairs. Insistent, the buzzer blatted again. My apartment was a walk-up on Fair Oaks, 3 blocks west of the Mission. The house was a Victorian, painted in 6 colors. I had 4 rooms, a deck, a hallway, and a view. Before the intercom went dead, the signal had become so weak and static-jammed, I wouldn't have recognized my mother's voice. Or screaming Jay Hawkins doing I Put a Spell on You, for that matter. I stood at the head of the stairway and pressed the door release, more curious than apprehensive, and watched 3 shadows dodge in out of the wet. There was a flash of lightning, horns and violins shrieked and re-shrieked the same tortured Slavic measure like a tocsin. They were coming up the stairs, thump, thump, thump. For one nasty moment I stepped back, cursing myself for so blindly buzzing them in. Gray forms, strangers, junkies, Mexican confidence men. When I saw with relief that it was Vogelsang. Felix, he said. Hey, I responded. He had a girl in tow, her hair clipped short as an East German swimmer's and bleached white. Behind her, 3 steps down, a guy in his late 20s, wearing rubbers and a yellow rain slicker that gave off a weird phosphorescent glow in the dull light of the hallway. All 3 of them looked as if they'd jumped off the Bay Bridge 4 or 5 times. Noses dripping, hair plastered, water dribbling from collars and shoes. Vogelsang was grinning his deranged grin. It's been a while, he said, clapping my shoulder. It had been 2 months. Vogelsang lived in splendid isolation in the hills above Bolinas, making money nefariously, practicing various perversions, collecting power tools, wood carvings, barber's poles, and cases of dry red wine from esoteric little vineyards like Goat's Crouch and Sangre de Cristo. He also collected antique motorcycles, copper saucepans, espresso machines the size of church organs, sexless mannequins from the 50s, which he painted, lacquered, and arranged round the house in lewd, arresting poses, bone-handled knives, Tahitian gill nets, and a series of cramped, somber oil paintings devoted to religious themes, like the decapitation of John the Baptist or the algolagnic ecstasies of the flagellants. Every few weeks he would descend on San Francisco to prowl junk shops, cruise North Beach, and attend sumptuous mate-swapping parties in Berkeley. Norman Mailer would have loved him. At this juncture, he maneuvered the girl forward. I noticed that she was wearing a delicate silver ring through the flange of her right nostril, and that her toenails were painted black. This is aorta, Vogelsang said. I labeled her instantly. Sorority girl cum punk. She was probably from Pacific Heights, and her real name was something like Jennifer Harris or Heather Mashburg. She gave me a hard look and held out her hand. Her hand was as wet and cold as something fished out of a pond. I ducked my head at her and sucked back the corners of my mouth. And this, Vogelsang was saying, gesturing toward the slickered figure 3 steps down, is Boyd Doust, a friend of mine from Santa Rosa. The rain slicker seemed to erupt in response, and a big bony hand lunged over the top of the rail to grasp mine. I was staring into the face of a Yankee farmer, angular, big-eared, eyes the color of power-line insulators. Now living in Sausalito, he said, clawing at his dripping hair with his free hand. The other hand, the friendly one, was still pumping at mine as if he expected my fingertips to squirt milk or something. I was barefoot, my bathrobe was dirty, the skipping record ripped at my nerves like a two-man saw. I invited them in. Vogelsang strode into the living room, unzipped his sodden jacket, and draped it across the back of a wooden chair. Characteristically brisk and nervous in the way of a feral cat attuned to the faintest movements, the tiniest scratchings. He smelled of rain, and something else, too, something musky and primal. It was a minute before I realized what it was. He reeked of sex. When he'd arranged the jacket to his satisfaction, he turned to enlighten me on this and other matters, pausing only to produce a plastic vial of breath neutralizer and squeeze off two quick shots before launching into a monologue describing his recent acquisitions, touching on improvements to his property in Bolinas and the progress of his investments in the commodities market, and giving a lubricious play-by-play account of the urbane orgy he and the girl had attended earlier in the evening. He spoke, as he always did, with a peculiar mechanical diction, each word distinct and unslurred, as if he were a linguistics professor moderating a panel discussion on the future of the language. I puttered round the apartment, half listening, changing the record, lowering the volume on the TV, digging out an ashtray, four bottles of beer, and a plastic envelope of pop. Vogelsang followed me, step for step, lecturing. Doust and the girl sat on the couch. As soon as the pot hit the coffee table, Doust snatched it up, opened the baggie and sniffed it. Breathed it, rather, like a snorkeler coming up for air, made a disdainful face and tossed the bag back down as if it contained some unspeakable refuse on the order of dog turds or decomposing sparrow eggs. I caught this out of the corner of my eye as I was slipping Stravinsky back into his jacket. Boyd's just finished up his master's degree at Yale, Vogelsang said, easing down on the arm of the couch and taking a swig of beer for dramatic emphasis, in botanical science. I pulled up a chair. Congratulations, I murmured, glancing at Doust and abruptly changed the subject. Who wanted to hear about some overgrown preppy and his academic laurels? I'd been that route myself. I said something about the rain, then made a bad joke about the quality of the entertainment at Vogelsang's party. You don't understand, Vogelsang persisted. Botanical science. He can grow anything, anywhere. I nodded. The girl was looking at me as if I were a sandwich in the window of a delicatessen, and Doust was squinting at a copy of Scientific American he'd dug out of the pile of newspapers on the floor.
This concludes our program on this cassette. Please call Books on Tape Incorporated for information about it or any title we have recorded. Please wind the cassette forward to its end so it will be in order for the next listener. Thank you.